is Wayne Sagar for AAFO.com's Warbird Talk Radio. Tonight our guest is Unlimited Air Racer Matt Jackson. Matt, welcome to Warbird Talk.
Well, thank you. It's very very kind of you to invite me to talk with you.
Well, it's good to talk with you, Matt. There's a lot of stuff you're involved with that the fans are interested in hearing about, and that's some stuff I'd like to jump right into, but I always like to ask, Matt, how did you get interested in flying?
Well, I was a child of an Air Force Master Sergeant, retired out of George Air Force Base where I was born, and I was raised around airplanes, and he started a small engine overhaul shop here in Van Nuys, California, back in the early 60s, and I was raised in the business, so I've been around aircraft all my life.
So you, at a young age, were exposed to the inner workings of airplanes, so you have quite a reputation as being a very good mechanic as well as a pilot.
Well, my father raised all his children in the business, and we, as any family that's run as a family business, you get into the inner workings from very little, and you have the ability to continue it on in your later years, and of course, the more years you have, the greater the experience, so I've been in it a long time.
That's a good thing for young people if they're thinking about aviation to don't be afraid of it, just jump in and look at it and do it.
Well, it's a real love affair for me. It's been my hobby as well as my business all my life, and I, as everybody probably is well aware, I'm an airplane fanatic, so I'm just very lucky. I thank God every day that day goes by that I'm still doing what I'm doing and enjoy it.
Now, were you actually involved with working on airplanes before you started flying lessons or getting flying?
Well, I started down at the airport tagging along with my dad from an early age of about 6 or 7. I can remember vividly hanging out and washing airplanes and sweeping floors and basically assisting my dad, or should I say interfering with my dad working from a very young age. So I've been doing it a long time, and slowly as I got older, I got greater and greater responsibilities. My actual flying started in the form of lessons when I was 11 years old.
Wow.
So my father, you know, had owned an airplane as a child when I was growing up, and I would always fly with him, but my real opportunity came when I was 11. He said, it's time for you to start learning how to fly. So I started taking lessons.
So you've been doing it for a while.
Long time. I'm 41 years old. I'll be 42 in November. So long time.
When did you first start being interested in racing airplanes?
Well, actually, I showed up with my mom and dad at the first Reno, if you can believe that one, when I was a child of 6 years old. And he was involved with the Cosmic Wind Racer Little Tony at the time. He had built the engine for it.
And what kind of an airplane was that?
It was a home-built Formula One. It was one of the aircraft built by the Lockheed engineers for Tony LeVere and Fish Salmon. Mm-hmm. There were several of them at the time, and this one was Tony LeVere's airplane, Little Tony, named after Tony's son. And at the time my father got involved, it was called the French Quarter Special. So, and it was owned by a gentleman, and I don't recall his name now, it's been so many years, but my father built the engine and sponsored the airplane for a couple of years in Reno.
Mm. So you certainly were exposed to some big names in aviation at an early age.
Well, what's interesting was when I showed up on the ramp, I was enamored with airplanes from that time on. Just the sight of watching them roar around just got me going, and to this day, I still get it. There's not a boring moment when you're at the ramp in Reno.
Yeah, that's for sure. Believe it or not, at 13 years old, I was very near that very same race on my bicycle, but we gave up. We didn't get out there, so I missed it. Took a number of years to get back. So that's where you got interested. When did you actually start getting into flying warbirds and think, gee, I can do that?
In 1977, in the summer of 77, I met Dave Zuschel down at the Van Nuys Airport, mm-hmm. and Dave was involved in, of course, many race programs over the year. He was a Merlin builder, as most of the fans know.
Yeah.
And upon my introduction to him, he started dragging me around working on the Warbirds. In 1978, in February or March of 78, I assisted him on doing a head and bank change on a P-51 called Cottonmouth, which was at the time owned by a Canadian by the name of Jerry Janes, which I'm sure everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry, upon the completion of his airplane, offered me an opportunity to fly the airplane, which I took heartily, and it's just been out of control ever since.
Now, was that a dual-control airplane?
No, it was a single place, a P-51D, and Jerry basically, if anybody knows Jerry, he's a big 6'6", 300-pound former Canadian football player star up there, and he said, "You're welcome to fly my airplane." He says, "If you tear it up, make sure you die in the crash, or I'll kill you when you get out of it." So I knew at the time the opportunity at hand, so I went ahead and took it. And some people have been lucky. I guess I was one of the lucky ones. I didn't have any mishaps, and it's been all uphill from there. So,
what kind of airplanes did you fly to lead up to that? That's a pretty good step from some airplanes.
Well, I'd flown most of the general aviation airplanes out there, everything that Piper and Cessna had to offer, and, of course, Beech. I had never flown anything like a Mustang in the way of horsepower performance in the general aviation field, really. But I attribute my experience on the 400 series Cessnas and some of the heavier general aviation airplanes that I used to fly. I used to deliver engines for my father's engine shop, and the airplanes were always at gross weight or over gross weight or darn near over gross weight with aft CGs. And mm-hmm. So I was used to handling airplanes that were right on the verge of not being real nice to fly. So when I crawl into the Mustang, I really attribute that experience to being able to fly the airplane successfully. And really the first 10 hours in any kind of airplane, new airplane that you get into, are the first hours of learning. And I was just very fortunate. I consider myself lucky, and I didn't have any mishaps. I didn't have any engine failures the first 10 hours. I made it through it, and it just went from there.
What a thrill. Must have been an amazing thrill. I know riding in the back seat was the first time was sure a thrill, but I can't imagine your first ride in a Mustang, flying one. Or was that actually your first ride in a Mustang?
Well, actually, Dave Zuschel put me in Cottonmouth and flew me out to Chino, where I did my first flight. And I had the opportunity to have one takeoff and one landing and view it from the back seat.
Oh, okay.
And I tell the funny story about Dave on the takeoff. We pulled out on the runway. He'd given me a very involved ground school session of about 10 minutes. And on our taxi out, he told me the do's and don'ts with the airplane. We pulled out onto the runway, and he said, "This is not how you want to do your first takeoff." And he went to the engine at the time, didn't have a boost control on it, and he went ahead and did a 90-inch takeoff with water alcohol. And the airplane just squalled, and of course it was so intimidating that I thought that that's what a normal takeoff was. Mm. We landed over at Chino, and he then went to explain to me that wasn't a normal takeoff, and that I should be very careful and apply the power very slowly.
Yeah, they press you back into the seat even when you're not doing a 90-inch takeoff.
Oh, it's an awesome airplane, and I look back with it. That first flight was a real experience for me. It was it turned out flawless. Like I said, I must have been lucky because I wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was real exciting.
Must not have been too bad. You survived the test of fire. You didn't have to die in the crash, so you didn't get beat up.
That's right. Well, like I said, it's... But, the old saying is, I'd rather be lucky than good.
Yeah, there you go. So from there on into racing, was it a number of years after that, or when was your actual first race?
Well, I went with the Genie team. Dave and Dennis Schoenfelter were the head of the Genie race team for Wiley Sanders in 80 and 81, and I tagged along with that group. I was a mechanic first.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to work on the airplanes, Dave kept giving me opportunities to ferry the airplanes around. I ferried quite a few of the racers over the next few years to and from Reno. And I always said that ferrying them is the dangerous part of the deal. Racing's the safe part. But taking them home after you whip on them is the dangerous part.
Yeah.
Over the rocks, we call it. So
mm-hmm.
I had the opportunity to get a lot of stick time for Dave. Any of the test flying for new engines he gladly gave to me, and I took it with open arms. So I got a lot of great experience in the first few years of flying many different Mustangs.
Seems, in talking to several of the pilots now, that a good portion of your opportunity is just being willing to fly sometimes.
Well, what's interesting, the opportunity for to fly that kind of airplane was once in a lifetime opportunity, and the doorway or the window of opportunity is very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And when the window appears, you have to leap into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready to go. I mean, it was a dream of mine from the time I was a little child to fly a Mustang. So as most pilots that love to fly, and when the opportunity came, I dropped everything. I mean, my job was on the back burner. My home life was on the back burner. I just focused on flying for several years after that first opportunity, and it paid off in a great way.
So you've told me before your weapon of choice, or the airplane you really like to fly, the Warbird, is the Mustang. And this year you've got a Mustang ride coming up in Voodoo. That you've got to be excited about that.
Well, I really am. The Mustang's always been my choice for several reasons. One, it has the potential, if it holds together, being the quickest thing out there. It certainly is the most dynamic of all the airplanes. It has the greatest history of any of the Warbirds. Everybody knows what a Mustang is.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're
so it's a handsome airplane. It's just great for what it does. It's a great race plane, and it's a great historic piece in a stock configuration. I mean, like I said, everyone knows what a Mustang is.
Actually, I didn't want to jump ahead like that, which I just did, but there was a project with Daryl Greenemeyer. You were involved with Keybird at all? Am I remembering right on that?
Yes. Daryl contacted me after locating that airplane up in Greenland and asked if I would come up and assist him in recovering it from the frozen cellar it was in.
It's an amazing project.
It really was. It was a tremendous undertaking. And it was something that had we successfully pulled it off, it would have been something to talk about for the rest of our lives. We came real close. We had an unfortunate turn of events at the end there.
And yeah, there was tragedy and triumph, but not complete triumph.
No, it's we have a saying in the group, you're either a hero or a zero, and we came out of that one a zero.
You know, I don't think in the eyes of anybody who watched that documentary, which, by the way, was a wonderfully well-done documentary. I wouldn't say that anybody that watched that would say that anybody there was a zero. You guys did an amazing feat getting to where you got.
Well, we were real excited about it, and again, it's a good lesson for doing these types of things. You have got to push and pay attention till you crawl in bed at night. And if you let down for 1 minute, when we got the airplane ready to fly, and we had all the engines running, there was a slight letdown in a lapse of common sense. And we were exhausted. The last time we were there, I believe we were there 20-some days in a row, and we were getting tired. We were exhausted. We were working around the clock. It was sunlight out. The sun was up day in and day out. There's no sunset at that time of year. And we were just pushing and pushing because the lake ice was starting to melt, and we had to get the airplane onto the lake to take off. And we pushed and pushed and pushed, and when it finally came to the moment to launch, we had a little lapse in judgment, and we didn't follow our plan.
Mm-hmm.
And we deviated from the plan, which is, and I tell everybody now, is a mistake. When you make a plan, you got to stick to the plan, no matter how silly it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a true statement, and we deviated from that plan, and we didn't inspect the airplane properly, and the APU in the back of the airplane was left unattended and running when Daryl taxied out onto the lake, and there was a temporary fuel tank that had been mounted to supply the fuel to that APU unit. It broke loose and flashed on the exhaust and went up. So it was something, and we had it in our checklist to shut down the APU and remove the fuel tank prior to taxi, and we did not do that.
Well, it's a good lesson to follow the checklist, I guess. Even
well, that's what I tell everybody. That's what checklists are for.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easy to get excited in the heat of the moment. But that was an amazing project, and I just wanted to ask you about that a little bit. There's another project, the fans. There's been a couple, and Daryl's name comes up in this. There's a couple of purpose-built air racers that have achieved legendary status. One is Daryl's Shockwave project, which I'm not sure of the status on, and the other one was commonly known as the Jackson Cornell Racer, and now more often referred to as American Spirit. What's the status on that airplane, Matt?
Well, the airplane currently has been relocated to my new shop out in California City. We are actively pursuing final funding for the program. A great deal of funding was provided by Howard Keck Sr. of the William E. Keck fame and Superior Oil.
Mm-hmm.
He had donated a lot of money to the cause, and we got real close to finishing the airplane prior to his death. He died several years ago in December, and it left a big void, a big hole in our funding. He was providing 100% of the funding on the airplane, and we were just getting up to the final stage when he passed away. He was 80, just turned 80 or 81 years old, and died from complications of heart problems.
Mm.
So we thought that we could continue on with the airplane, and because we are very close to finishing the airplane, and of course, when the funding was shut down, we started having difficulties with our suppliers and people working on it. Obviously, people have to be paid.
So right.
We put it temporarily. We stored the aircraft at Dave Cornell, my partner's home, in hopes of acquiring funding immediately. And of course, that funding, we had a lot of promises. And Walker, Bob Walker Jr. of Walker Engineering, he donated some money to the program and was going to fund it, and then had a change of heart, had a financial reversal, and required him to focus on things in his own life rather than our race plane. So we had a shutdown on the project awaiting additional funding. And of course, weeks turned into months turns into years, and it's been a couple years now since we've really done much to the airplane. The airplane is about 75% completed. It was on its gear. The engine mount was completed. We were installing systems. The hydraulic systems are all in the airplane. The wings are attached to the fuselage, and we're basically just in the middle of putting systems in, so it's real close.
There's actually not a great deal of knowledge out about that airplane, or general knowledge. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is the design based on? It's kind of a compilation, isn't it?
Well, it was interesting. Dave Cornell, my partner, who is really the spearhead behind the design on the airplane, was in a design contest with a gentleman by the name of Carl Friend, who a lot of racers know as an old-time aerodynamicist. And Dave was a kind of a student of Carl Friend, and they had a design competition back many, many years ago about how to build a race plane out of existing parts, because designing and building an airplane from scratch is very, very costly and time-consuming.
Right.
People are aware of the Tsunami project over the years. That was a one-design airplane. Took from beginning to finish, took many, many, many years. So Dave got into this design contest with Carl and came up with several different designs. And I believe another person was involved in the design of several other airplanes. And it was a contest to see who had the best airplane design. And Dave actually won the contest. When they all sat down and laid their ideas out, Dave had the best idea and most cost-efficient. What it basically spearheads around is a T2 Buckeye wing. It's a North American design. It's a laminar flow wing. Highly efficient, very high-speed airfoil. It's very rugged. It was built for carrier qualifications. It's got a very, very strong spar in it. Typical North American design, and very rugged landing gear. And the race plane is designed around a nose gear design, where most of the race planes are tail draggers. The idea behind the nose wheel, several reasons. One, the primary reason is because the main landing gear is positioned aft, more aft in the wing. It allows greater airfoil design and airflow in the critical areas of the wing, where a tail dragger, the gear is mounted in the leading edge of the wing.
Mm-hmm.
and you have gear door seams and a sealing problem in that area, by moving the gear aft, you essentially eliminate that gear door leakage problem in the critical area of the airfoil. So there, more of the wing is laminar flow, therefore greater speed is obtained. The fuselage, of course, is home built around 3350, which is our power plant of choice. It's the most powerful, most efficient way of producing horsepower to drag available. It was the zenith of development in the radial engines. It will put out more horsepower per pound than any other engine out there, and it will do it efficiently and continuously. So Rare Bear was a good example of this engine, how well it can work by the years of consecutive wins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great engine. It runs cool, it produces a lot of horsepower, and it's exactly what the doctor ordered. So designed around the 3350, and then we go to the tail section. We utilize the tail section of the T2 Buckeye simply because it had it's a very small structure. It's very strong. It gives a high horizontal stabilizer position to keep the tail in what we call clean air.
Right.
And allow, again, a surface of the airplane to maintain its laminar flow at higher speeds. It has speed brakes on it, which gives us a big benefit in emergencies. And so it was really a well-thought-out design by Dave. Dave really did his homework on it, spent many years coming up with the design. So he's really the one to be congratulated on the design. Once that design was looked at, a lot of other very important people, a gentleman by the name of Jim Chase, who's also another design engineer, looked at it. Analytical Methods up in up north, their company looked at it and ran all the numbers, and everybody's was on the same page on agreement. They said this airplane with this much horsepower should really rip, was their statement. So it really is, as far as we're concerned, and what little I can tell you about aerodynamics, what I've been shown and what I've flown, it should be a real, real, real performer. And that's what we were looking for.
What's the estimated weight of it at completion?
Well, you know, everybody asked me that question, and all I can tell you is every unlimited race plane in the class that is a top contender weighs within 1,000 pounds of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Rare Bear's just over 10,000 pounds. A P-51 Mustang like Voodoo, Strega, or Dago Red are all in the high nines. So you're talking within a few hundred pounds of one another. The only unlimited race plane that is really out of that class is like Dreadnought, which is a huge airplane. When you look at a Sea Fury, it is a large airplane, and it's around 12,000 pounds. But if you calculate the horsepower you need, the distance you got to go, and how much liquid you have to carry, the weight of the airplane is really dictated by the length of the race.
Now, is the wing on the Buckeye a sweep at all, or is that a straight wing?
No, it's a straight wing. A sweep doesn't buy you in anything until you get in up to the supersonic speeds, and we're not talking supersonic speeds here. We're talking about an airplane that's going to operate around 0.72 Mach. Mm-hmm. And so a sweep really is a detriment to an airplane, a propeller-driven airplane going fast. A straight wing planform with the Reynolds, correct Reynolds numbers that maintains high laminar flow is the difference. Now, for example, Rare Bear does not have a laminar flow airfoil. It's got a Clark Y airfoil, which is similar to a J3 Cub.
Mm-hmm.
So when Rare Bear goes out there and goes fast, it goes fast for two reasons. One, it has tremendous horsepower. When you talk about the horsepower that airplane's putting out, you're talking about go fast on that pretense. They've shortened the wings tremendously. They've slicked and sealed up that fuselage and the rest of that airplane to the point where it's as efficient. It's driving at its critical Mach number, and it can actually go beyond its critical Mach number. So when you see John Penny or Lyle out there charging on the course, it's not that they're running out of horsepower. If they're running second place, they're running out of airframe.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the temperature of the day, they need a good, warm day to safely go fast in that airplane. And after my experience of flying that airplane, boy, you get a cool day that comes up. You know, the engines love cool days. They make a lot of horsepower. So that airplane actually on a cool day can be very unruly. I mean, the handling starts going out the window on it. You've got to be very, very careful. It's one of the few airplanes I've flown that you really have to pay attention to.
And that's because of the density of the air?
That's correct. When you start talking about pushing up its critical Mach number, it's actually flying over its red line when you're on the course, whereas a Mustang is still under its red line when you're at full tail boogie out there on the course. And the Mustang, although it's getting into its upper realm of handling, is still better at high-speed handling than the Bearcat is.
So does it get a tendency to want to swap ends? I think I've heard that rumor.
Well, the airplane becomes pitch unstable. That's
okay, up and down.
When the shock wave starts moving aft on the wing, at some point on the race course, depending on the air density out there, you can actually see the shock wave forming on the leading edge of the wing.
Oh.
And it's quite a scene. And when that shock wave starts happening, you start getting a center of pressure on your airfoil starts shifting aft, and then the airplane becomes pitch unstable.
Mm.
And they're coming down the chute. It's very, 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 very critical not to exceed its critical Mach number, because that airplane is right on the verge of being out of control.
Mm.
And when you race it, it's something. When I crawled in that airplane, I had no concept of how critical it was until I started flying it. And it is a pilot's airplane, there's no question about it. And that, my hat's off to Lyle and John for the accomplishments they've made in that airplane, because it is a handful at speed. It is not a Bearcat. When somebody says a Bearcat, it brings to mind a great flying, great handling, great climbing, great utility airplane that every pilot that's ever flown a Bearcat, that's the plane of choice. That is not a Bearcat. It is only Bearcat in name.
Looks a little like a Bearcat.
It looks like a Bearcat. It might taxi like a Bearcat, but when the canopy rolls closed, that's where it ends. It does not fly like a Bearcat. I've flown a stock one, and I can tell you it is not a stock Bearcat.
You know, just as a side note, I don't know if you guys were aware of it last year. Did you know the gear door, left gear door, was blown down about a half an inch or more?
Well, we had several problems with the airplane. Yes, we were aware of that. We had several reports of that. The gear on that airplane, the airplane accelerates so rapidly. I don't know if you were watching the takeoffs in the airplane, but as the airplane starts to bobble and get light on the gear, you're actually getting the gear cycle going. And there were a couple takeoffs there. If you had watched, I was still on the ground and the gear was folding. You literally have to get the gear going immediately, because if you don't, it will not get on the up locks and the doors will not close properly. So
because you've actually gone above the gear speed?
The gear speed. The airplane breaks ground at about 100 knots, and from there it accelerates to 200 knots in a blink of an eye. The minute the wheels come off the ground, you are going through your gear speed. It is the most amazing accelerator. It doesn't look like much on takeoff. In fact, we're only using a very small portion of the horsepower. We're using about 1,600 horsepower to take off is all. But that 1,600 horsepower takes that airplane, and it accelerates now. So you go through your gear. First time I flew it, God, I went through the gear speed by 40 miles an hour before I could get it up. And then I didn't get it up. I had to slow the airplane up and recycle it. So there's a technique to flying that airplane.
So the word that's out there among the fans that airplane is a handful is no BS.
That's no BS, and maybe I'm a weenie, but it took everything I had to operate that airplane in a safe manner. And without John Penny's input and without Lyle's input of operating the airplane for years, I would not have wanted to crawl in that airplane and think that I could have operated it safely without their input. I mean, John was, I can't tell you how much insight he gave me into flying that airplane.
He's quite a good pilot, isn't he?
John is an he is so low-keyed. He's not a, I liken all the race pilots. Skip Holmes is a perfect example of what everybody looks at as a race pilot. He's outgoing. He's jovial. He's a hard charger. He's a talented man. He's a great friend of mine. He's somebody I look up to. But he's totally opposite than John in personality. John is very quiet, very calculated, methodical. John, even though Skip is a Lockheed trained or a Air Force trained test pilot and worked for Lockheed in the Skunk Works, he is a different type of test pilot. Skip is, you know, six guns blazing and hang on, and he always brings the plane back. John, on the other hand, is calculated. He knows what he's going to do before he goes out to the airport in the morning to go fly. He's incredible. He takes notes. He makes little notes and messages to himself to cover all the points. He's incredible on his test flights. He comes back with just incredible amounts of data. Whereas I'll go out on a flight and bring back two squawks. He'll go out on a flight and bring back 20 squawks.
And he's very fast in the airplane.
Oh, he makes the airplane sings for him. There's no question about it. He's methodical. He knows how fast he's going to go before he gets in the airplane and taxis out. He knows what power setting he's going to run. He knows the temperature. He knows the density. He knows what it's going to indicate. He knows where he's going to go on the course. He is phenomenal. And just being around him, I was so lucky this last year to hang out in that pit, because you have Lyle Shelton, who is the racer's racer.
He really is.
And, I mean, he is what everybody dreams to be in racing. He is he's a slow-talking, slow-walking guy, but you stick him in a race plane and stand back. You don't want to be in his sights because he'll shoot you down. I mean, he's got ice water runs in his veins when he crawls in that airplane, and that's what you have to have. And he is what everybody wishes they could be in a race pilot. And then you've got John Penny, who is... He takes the fear and the doubt out of it. He really gives you a very methodical plan, and I was so very, very happy and proud to work with the team, because those two guys are just incredible. They really are. They made my adventure in the airplane palatable. I don't think I would have flown the airplane in the race this last year had it not been for Lyle and John.
Mm-hmm. Lyle is someone that you were introduced to at a very early age, isn't he?
Well, what's interesting, in 69, he brought out the Rare Bear, and it was his first year with it. And I, as a small child, I was 10 or 11 years old at the time, I had gone out and I had drawn a picture. I don't know if I told you the story or not, but I had drawn a picture of the airplane on a big sheet of paper, and I wanted him to get him to sign it for me, which he did. And at the time, I looked at the airplane and walked around with my dad. And Lyle had asked me, he said, "What are you going to do when you grow up?" I said, "Well, I'd love to be a race pilot and fly this airplane." Of course, everybody chuckled, and Lyle patted me on the head, and off I went. And from then on, every year I would hang out in the pits. I'd always go by and see Lyle and all the gang, and I'd see all the other race pilots. And of course, I was a big fan of Darryl's. And so as I grew up and the opportunity came about to deal with these famous people and get involved in their airplanes and work on them and do all that, I took the opportunity, and lo and behold, here 30 years later, I'm flying Lyle Shelton's race plane.
Yeah, you did tell us that story, but I wanted to hear it again because it's such a wonderful story.
You know, and it was funny, I dug up and I found the picture here the other day. I still have the picture signed by him, and I kept it all those years, folded up, tucked away in one of my little boxes as a kid you get, you know, with all
mm-hmm.
your little mementos.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite a story.
Well, it just goes to show you that dreams can come true, and there's no problem dreaming.
Well, it's everybody's dreams are the doorway to the future, and I've always felt that when you have the ability to dream and it's within the realm of reality, you can accomplish it, and I've accomplished so many things that I dreamt when I was a child, saying I want to do that, and just keeping the desire and keep striving and just plugging along. All it takes is time, and it comes along. And I always say you get two opportunities in life to do what you dream, and the first time most people pass on it because they don't believe it's happening. The second time, if they miss it, they never get another opportunity. So I go on the premise, I'm a hard charger. If the opportunity comes, I jump at it if I want to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the nice things about air racing, aside from being really thrilling for those of us that are addicted to that part of it. Hopefully some kids, and I've seen this, some of the local kids at Stead, I've seen them sneak in through the press gate, actually, and go right around and with eyes as big as saucers looking at those big airplanes. And if all of that can bring a couple of pilots even into the world, That's a good thing.
Well, I can tell you over the years, you know, for years they didn't allow children in the pits.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, I lost count of how many times I hid under jackets and pillows and in toolboxes and in tool trailers going into those pits. And you could literally stop any crew bus that was going in as a kid going into Reno and ask to be snuck into the pits, and they all said, yeah, come on, jump in, and they put you down underneath their feet,
lay
ice chests on top of you and cover you with jackets. And I was never, ever skunked out of the pits at Reno, even when as a kid we were outlawed for being in the pits. I think it was anybody under 13 couldn't go in. Well, I'll tell you, I attended a lot of races that we were outlawed in the pits.
Well, that's one of the nice things that the Reno Air Race Association's done last year, and they're going to do again this year, is they're bringing in a lot of school kids. You'll see that we saw it last year, the tours of students going through the pits. What a fascinating thing if they can, if that can spark their interest and get more people or more of them interested in aviation in one way or another.
You know, the children are the future of aviation. And
yeah.
Aviation is such a small field anyway, and it's such a depleted field. I mean, now with airlines and I mean planes in general, everybody, the majesty of aviation has dwindled to the point that everybody considers an airplane as transportation.
Yeah.
The glory and the mystique of aircraft are held in the minds of just a few, and children still have that glisten in their eye, and if you don't cultivate it from a very early age, they lose it.
Yeah.
So I've brought several young people in under my wing through the years that have gone up. One's in the Air Force Academy now, and one is a flight instructor going getting his ratings to go for the airlines. And I take a lot of pride in that, because that's the only way we're going to hold aviation together, especially general aviation, to teach the young.
And it's such a wonderful experience to, I've never gotten my license, but the little flying that I've been allowed to do with people, it's such a wonderful experience to do it. It would just be sad if it dwindled to the point where it wasn't accessible for people.
Well, see, I can't imagine, as an adult now, what life would have been without airplanes or flying. And I tell everybody, every time I crawl into a cockpit, and I don't care if it's a Cessna 150 or it's Rare Bear or one of the jets that I own or fly, it's the same exhilarating experience every time I taxi out and pull up and line up with that runway. Mm-hmm. I tell everybody, you worry about everything that goes on in your life until you roll out on the runway and you lock the tailwheel. And once you lock that tailwheel, the party is on, and your mind focuses in flying, and it's the most exhilarating thing that I have ever done in my life and will continue to do. And it's the same day in and day out. I'm never bored with flying. I never say, gee, I don't want to go because I'm bored. I don't go because I'm sick or the weather's bad.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's the same thrill, really. It's more of what level you're exposed, but it's the same thrill flying in a Cessna 150 if you're the one flying it.
Oh, absolutely.
As you move up.
I treasure the moments that I can go bebop around in a J3 Cub or hop in one of my Navions or go fly in my MiG-15. I mean, it's the same exhilaration. Doesn't matter if you're going 500 miles an hour or 50 miles an hour. It's that thrill of flying.
You have a MiG-15. Would you consider racing that in the jet class if that gets going at Reno?
You know, I'd love to do that. But to be honest with you, I've got this commitment with Voodoo,
mm-hmm.
with Mr. Button, and I really, really want to work on working and trying to make this happen for Bob. Bob's a real gentleman, and he's been real kind to me over the years. I've known him for years, and his father knew my father, so it's kind of a family affair. Mm-hmm. I know his uncle and his aunt real well, Bob and Faye Douthat, and it's something I want to really accomplish, and it's going to take 100% of my attention. I mean, I'm going up there this next year to do exactly what I've been asked to do, and it's fly that airplane and make it as successful as I possibly can. And that's going to take all of my attention. So I'd love to fly in the jet class, but, you know, it's really not in the cards for me over the next. I've got a 5-year agreement with Bob, and I'm going to give him the best 5 years that I can and try and be successful for him. so that's really important.
We're looking at seeing Matt Jackson for 5 years in Voodoo. That's nice.
Well, it's a 5-year plan that Bob came up with. He's Bob is really an incredible guy. He's not a flash in the night as a lot of racers have been through the years, where they come in and spend a lot of money and then leave dejected or they don't have any success. Bob is very methodical. He's had a plan. The plan has essentially been a 10-year plan, and he's got 5 years left on his 10-year plan, and the next 5 years are going to be real exciting, and I think you're going to see a lot of great things for that airplane. I hope that I'm part of those great things. I hope I can live up to Bob's expectations on flying the airplane. I'm really excited about it. And he's got a great team, a lot of dedicated people, and Bob is really dedicated to the sport. I mean, he truly is a racer, and he's one of the last of the real diehards. I mean, there's Tiger, there's Lyle, there's the Sanders, the Dwellies. I mean, you're talking about people. It's dwindling, and the reality of it is, it's so expensive to do. And it's such a dedication in your life. Everybody thinks, oh, you only go out there and race for a week once a year.
No, it's year-round.
It is a year-round spectacle, because the minute that airplane gets back from Reno after the race, you are scheming and planning and finagling and angling and ordering and stockpiling and doing all these things just so you can go up and try and do it the next year. And people, I try and tell fans when I see them and people come up and talk to me, it is such an endeavor to operate one of these airplanes and be even in contention. I'm not talking just going out there and flying, but just to be in contention with the top 10 airplanes is a monumental undertaking. And anybody tells you that it isn't is kidding themselves. Mm-hmm. And the financial burden it puts on these people, I truly believe we are the craziest bunch of people on the planet. I mean, we are taking something that absolutely, if you win everything at Reno, you don't break, and you win, and you take every heat race, and you put that little extra punch of money they stick in your pocket for winning the heat race, and you leave there a victor, and you fly your airplane home, and nothing is broken, it still costs you twice as much as you won.
Yeah.
I don't care how you cut it.
I think somebody once told me the little joke, how to make a small fortune in air racing, start with a big one.
That's right. I tell you, I've had my taste in 1992 when I campaigned Stiletto, and I had my taste this last year with Rare Bear, and I can only tell you that it is the most unbelievable financial burden that I have experienced in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about burning money. We have a joke. Alan Preston from the Museum of Flying has a funny story. He says, you would be better off, you could go out and buy a brand new Ferrari 308 GT, drive it the week of Reno, pull up, every day you park it with valet, and on Sunday or Monday morning when you leave to go home, throw the keys to the valet.
You
would be better off than going unlimited air racing at Reno. And and it's the truth. We joke about it, we laugh about it, but that is the reality of it. There is no common sense in what we do except out of the love of doing it.
And there is indeed that, because a good portion of the people involved with making the airplanes go faster, volunteers who work hour after hour, as I'm sure you're seeing.
It's thousands and thousands of hours of people's lives buried in those airplanes, and it's spent over a 10-day period. And at the end of that 10-day period, it's like you've run 5 New York marathons.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't describe it to the average Joe Blow, to the average mechanic that's never, we call it thrashing. On that 10 days of Reno, we do more work on that airplane than it sees all year long.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about just a multitude of people. Everybody in every pit is doing something on his plane and helping on something on another race plane.
That's a neat thing, too, how everybody helps each other.
It really is, and everybody in that pit, that in that unlimited class, and in all the classes, I say unlimited, I mean Formula One's T6 class, every one of those guys are spirited competitors, but they, above all, are friends and companions. and it's incredible when you see. My biggest thrill is to go up and see my friends in Reno, to be with people that I don't see all year long, or I only talk to them a few times a year, and I get to actually be shoulder to shoulder with people that I admire and enjoy flying with. I mean, I am more relaxed in an unlimited race with people that I fly with every year at Reno. Everybody says, oh, it must be really scary coming down the chute in that formation. You don't even think about it because you know you're not going to hit your wing, your guy, and he, and that other guy's not going to run into you. And it's an incredible feeling. Maybe it's a false feeling of security. Maybe it's a wild and crazy statement. But the reality is you are so accustomed to having that person and talking and being with that person and knowing what he's thinking and how he's reacting that you can actually do something like that and have the peace of mind. I mean, the unlimited race is an incredible thing. It really is.
Yeah. The whole sport is just an incredible sport. There's no way you can describe it to anybody. They just have to go. You can tell people for 2 hours and show them videotapes and play recordings, but there's no way, on a spectator standpoint even, that it can be described. You have to experience it.
I tell my line is it's the fastest motorsport on earth.
It is.
And it is an adrenaline rush of untold magnitude, and that's exactly what it is.
And it's infectious. You guys are spreading that adrenaline as you go around the course because everybody that's watching's got it.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. And I've had a lot of people ask me, "Gee, when are you going to give it up?" And I said, "When they shoot me down."
Well, Matt, I'm running out of time. Unfortunately, these things are. Just that's the bad part about this this format we've been using is we just don't have as much time as we'd like. I'm really, really hopeful that you can get the backing you need to get American Spirit done. This airplane sounds like it has a tremendous potential.
Well, we're really hoping that my plan is to finish the airplane. Whether it's finished quickly or over the period of the next few years, it will be completed one way or the other. I am really looking for additional sponsorship so we can complete the airplane. I'm willing to give up interest in the airplane, whether it be partial or sole ownership in it, just to get the airplane completed and get it out there because it has such a tremendous potential. We've had everybody from Lockheed to Boeing to people in the know, I mean people that are involved in really serious aerodynamics with airplanes, that tell us the same thing. And we spent a great deal of money on the aerodynamics on this airplane and the design. Dave Cornell is a brilliant man, and he has really gone to extremes to develop this airplane and design. And I really want to see it for him, too. I think that it'd be a real nice notch in his belt and to have this thing completed and flying. And I know I really am looking forward to flying the airplane because I think it can be a winner.
Well, it's always great to see the warbirds come out to Reno, but there's just something special when you see a special built come out. There's just such a mystique involved with something that's purpose built.
Well, and another big thing too is I think that the day of the of utilizing these very valuable airplanes is coming to a close. I mean, they're getting sparse and just priceless. And as much as I love to fly them and go out there and race them, I see the need to start developing and going in another direction. Maybe someday, who knows, we'll have something like the Formula One class in the Unlimiteds where everybody's got a new designed airplane. I mean, the Formula One, if you want to see real racing and ingenuity, go to the Formula One pits. Those are the guys that are flying and the stuff they built from scratch.
Well, interestingly enough, the sport class is actually taking off much more than I thought it might. With John Sharp jumping in, and his next Nemesis NXT is going to be a sport class racer. And I understand, I haven't gotten to speak to him about it yet, but I understand Daryl Greenmeyer is going to be there this year in a sport class.
Yeah, you know, Daryl was talking about it. He said he wanted to get into some kind of racing that was more reasonable and affordable. And it's certainly, boy, you talk about a racing fool there.
Yeah.
Back.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what class he's in. He's going to set it afire. So.
Well, that class has the potential to produce some interesting designs within the formula that they have. It's going to be very interesting. It's in its infancy, and I'm getting more and more interested in watching it. It's going to be fun, I think, over the next few years.
It should be really, really exciting, and I hope it it expands and draws more people into this sport, because we really need the, without the fans and the crowds, this can't continue. I mean, it's the fans that keep this air racing alive.
Yeah.
It's not just the money. We've got to have the support of the people out there, the drive that they input into the local governments and stuff to allow us to continue to do this. Because at some point, without the fans, it's not going to happen. We're going to be shut down for things just like happened with Gary here last year.
Yeah.
We're going to have that kind of tragedy. I don't care how careful you are, how long you do it, to what expense you go. I mean, nobody was more cautious, was more aware of the dangers of air racing than Gary Levitz. And to have something like that happen, it's a tragedy. But, you know, it's the price we pay for exceeding the envelope. And we can't continue to do that and not expect ramifications from the local governments and the FAA. And without the fans pushing the buttons of those people, I mean, the only thing that keeps the FAA and the local governments at bay are the fans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the fans say we want it, that's the government, local government's job to see that they get it. And without the fans' help, we can't continue. So I'm a real supporter of the fans coming out. And, hey, anybody that's out there that wants to come through our pit and hang out and have a look-see, you're more than welcome to come by. We'll give you a tour. We really, without the fans, it can't happen. So our arms are open to anybody who wants to come in and have a look and hang out and see what it's like to be in the pits with a real race plane, because we want to support the race. All the racers want to do this. I mean, if anybody that you've known, you talk to them, if anybody has a story where they tell you they were run out of a pit of an unlimited race, they're lying to you. In air racing, it's just the opposite. Now, I've been to some car races where I've been run out,
mm-hmm.
mind you.
Yeah.
But that's a whole different deal. Air racing, you talk about a warm bunch of wonderful guys. That's what it's all about.
That's certainly been my experience. And we'll certainly take you up on stopping by and seeing how you're doing with Voodoo. Looking real, looking forward a lot to seeing Voodoo do well this year and for you to have a good ride in the airplane, Matt. Wish you all the luck in the world. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us tonight on Warbird Talk.
Okay,
I sure appreciate
you asking me, and I'm happy to do it, and I think you got a great thing going here.
Well, thanks a lot, Matt. It's been great talking to you, and we'll definitely like to talk to you again, like maybe after you get that trophy at Reno this year.
Boy, I hope so. Keep your fingers crossed.
All right, thanks a lot, Matt.
Bye-bye.